watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go right.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fitter Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The material on the show this week will present evidence that the three steel skyscrapers that collapsed in New York City on September 11, 2001, did so as a result of controlled demolition, and that the airplane crashes provided the cover but were not the cause of the collapses, and that the rigging of the sophisticated sequence of explosions suggested by the evidence could only have been an inside job by highly skilled experts. I hope that you can tape this program in order to share it with others, or if not, download it later as an MP3 from unwelcomeguests.org and distribute it that way. You'll have a couple of minutes to set up a recorder or call someone and ask them to tune in. The material is very detailed and sometimes technical, and you may also want to hear it more than once. Why is getting to the truth about the collapse of the buildings on 9/11 of such central importance? Because a particular government-propagated and widely accepted version of the events of that day has been the justification for an endless war on terrorism, the invasion of two countries, the USA Patriot Act, the creation of a Department of Homeland Security that seems to devote a great deal of its efforts to harassing government critics, an official program of torture, enemy combatants, arbitrary arrest, and so-called extraordinary renditions, a ballooning military budget, and billions of tax dollars that vanish either into thin air or into the pockets of a few well-connected corporations while impoverishment spreads nationally and globally. The creation of a surveillance and snitch culture, the increasing classifying of information on government's activities, and the assumption of imperial power for the president as commander-in-chief. These measures have been justified by politicians and in the press as necessary to protect the populace from another 9/11 type attack. And indeed, as recently as this week, George Bush claims these measures have in fact done so. Meanwhile, according to former weapons inspector Scott Ritter, the Bush administration is planning a nuclear attack on Iran. The rallying cry for each new government clampdown is "Remember 9/11," a cry that entrances our body politic like the post-hypnotic suggestion of a mesmerist. Be afraid, don't think, obey. But what if those claiming the mantle of protectors from terrorism are in fact the perpetrators of terror, who are pursuing a vicious realpolitik in order to consolidate power over the nation and, by the extension of its military, the world? It would not be the first time governments have done this, nor would it be the first time the U.S. government created or attempted to create a provocative incident to bring the people in line with the desired outcomes of top officials. A study of history is important for this reason. And as a preface to the presentation on the 9/11 building collapses, I'd like to read you some passages from James Bamford's book, Body of Secrets, The Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency, that was published in 2001. This deals with a proposed secret military plan called Operation Northwoods. The time period is the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations in the late 1950s and early 60s. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in a report on the problems of right-wing extremism in the military, warned that there was considerable danger in the education and propaganda activities of military personnel that had been uncovered. Running through all of them is a central theme that the primary, if not exclusive, danger to this country is internal communist infiltration, said the report. Among the key targets of the extremists, the committee said, was the Kennedy administration's domestic social program, which many ultra-conservatives accused of being communistic. The thesis of the nature of the communist threat, the report warned, often is developed by equating social legislation with socialism and the latter with communism. Much of the administration's domestic legislative program, including continuation of the graduated income tax, expansion of Social Security, particularly medical care under Social Security, federal aid to education, etc., under this philosophy would be characterized as steps towards communism. The chilling Senate study concluded by warning of a revolt by senior military officers, such as the one portrayed in 7 Days in May. To show the idea was not far-fetched, the report cited as an example of the ultimate danger the recent revolt by army generals in France, largely over policies in Algeria. Military officers, French or American, have some common characteristics arising from their profession, said the report, and there are numerous military fingers on the trigger throughout the world, close quote. Finally, the committee specifically pointed to General Lemnitzer of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and called for an examination of the relationship between him, his chiefs, and the extreme right-wing groups. Among the member of the committee most outspoken in calling for an investigation of Lemnitzer and the Joint Chiefs was Senator Albert Gore, Sr. of Tennessee, the father of the former Vice President Al Gore. It was not an idle worry. In their 1963 book, The Far Right, Donald Jansen of the New York Times and CBS reporter Bernard Eisman wrote, "Concern had grown that a belligerent and freewheeling military could conceivably become as dangerous to the stability of the United States as the mixture of rebelliousness and politics had in nations forced to succumb to juntas or fascism. The agony that gripped France as a result of military defectors' efforts to reverse government policy on Algeria was another forceful reminder of the inherent dangers in allowing political power to build up in the military establishment," close quote. Outwardly, Lemnitzer remained stiff and correct, but deep inside he was raging at the new and youthful Kennedy White House. He felt out of place and out of time in a culture that seemed suddenly to have turned its back on military tradition. Lemnitzer had no respect for the civilians he reported to. He believed they interfered with the proper role of the military. The civilian hierarchy was crippled not only by inexperience, he would later say, but also by arrogance arising from failure to recognize its own limitations. The problem was simply that the civilians would not accept military judgments, close quote. In Lemnitzer's view, the country would be far better off if the generals could take over. But for those military officers who were sitting on the fence, the Kennedy administration's botched Bay of Pigs invasion was the last straw. President Kennedy was pilloried by the super patriots as a no-win chief. The far right became a fount of proposals born of frustration and put forward in the name of anti-communism. Although no one in Congress could have known it at the time, Lemnitzer and the Joint Chiefs had quietly slipped over the edge. According to secret and long-hidden documents obtained for Body of Secrets, the Joint Chiefs of Staff drew up and approved plans for what may be the most corrupt plan ever created by the U.S. government. In the name of anti-communism, they proposed launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting an ill-conceived war they intended to launch against Cuba. Codenamed Operation Northwoods, the plan, which had written approval of the chairman, that's of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for boats carrying refugees fleeing Cuba to be sunk on the high seas, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit. Planes would be hijacked. Using phony evidence, all of it would be blamed on Castro, thus giving Lemnitzer and his cabal the excuse as well as the public and international backing they needed to launch their war. The idea may actually have originated with President Eisenhower in the last days of his administration. With the Cold War hotter than ever and the recent U-2 scandal fresh in the public's memory, the old general wanted to go out with a win. He wanted desperately to invade Cuba in the weeks leading up to Kennedy's inauguration. Indeed, on January 5th, he told Lemnitzer and other aides in his cabinet room that he would move against Castro before the inauguration if only the Cubans gave him a really good excuse. Then, with time growing short, Eisenhower floated an idea. If Castro failed to provide that excuse, perhaps, he said, the United States could, quote, think of manufacturing something that would be generally acceptable, close quote. What he was suggesting was a pretext, a bombing, an attack, an act of sabotage, carried out secretly against the United States by the United States. Its purpose would be to justify the launching of a war. It was a dangerous suggestion by a desperate president. That from James Bamford's book published in 2001, Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency, History, Fact. Now we're pleased once again to bring you Dr. David Ray Griffin, Claremont College Professor Emeritus of Theology, who has written two books that analyze the omissions and distortions in the government story. This presentation was given on October 15th in New York City and focuses entirely on the question of controlled demolition. We will follow it by an excerpt of a recent lecture on this same topic by physicist Stephen Jones of Brigham Young University. Given that this is a radio show, we're unable to present videos and photographs that provide much of the source data for the analysis you will hear, but we will provide links on our website on welcomeguest.org so that you may view these for yourself.
The first book on 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor, I summarized dozens of facts and reports that contradicted the official story about 9/11. Then in my second book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, I showed how the 9/11 Commission dealt with all those facts and reports that were summarized in my first book. That is, they simply ignored almost all of them, and a few they decided they could deal with by distorting them. So, and in my previous lectures, too, I've given an overview because I believe the most powerful argument about 9/11 is the cumulative argument. You don't just focus on one thing and say everything hinges on this. You show that no matter where you begin with the official story, there are huge holes in it, contradictions of facts. No part of the official story stands up. That is very important to realize. But one problem with that big picture approach is that the treatment of every particular issue has to be quite brief and therefore superficial. And that opens the way for people who still suspect that the official story is true to say, well, if we looked at any of those things more deeply, maybe we would see the official story stands up. So what I'm going to do tonight is focus on one question and one question only. That is, why did the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapse. One advantage of this focus, besides the fact that it allows me to deal with it in some detail, is that the destruction of the World Trade Center, I think, provides, if not the best, at least one of the best windows into the truth about 9/11. Another advantage is that this will allow us to look at some detail at the revelations that were contained in the 9/11 oral histories, which were recorded by the New York Fire Department shortly after 9/11, but released only this past August. So I will begin with the question of why the towers collapsed and then do the same with Building 7. Shortly after 9/11, President Bush advised people not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories about the attacks of 11 September. Philip Zelikow, who directed the 9/11 Commission report, has likewise warned against outrageous conspiracy theories. Well, what do these men mean by this expression? They cannot mean that we should reject all conspiracy theories about 9/11, because, of course, the official story itself is a conspiracy theory, according to which 19 Arab Muslims outwitted the most sophisticated military defense system in history and also defeated several laws of physics, as I will talk about later. So they mean only that we should reject outrageous theories. But what is the difference between an outrageous theory and a non-outrageous theory? Well, this is one of the main questions in the philosophy of science. When confronted by rival theories, let's say neo-Darwinian evolution and intelligent design, scientists and philosophers of science ask, which is the better theory and why? Well, a good theory is one that will deal with all, or at least most, of the relevant facts in a coherent way, can explain them, and is not contradicted by any of the relevant facts. A bad theory is one that is contradicted by some of the relevant facts. An outrageous theory would be one that is contradicted by virtually all of the facts. With this definition in mind, let us look at the official theory about the Twin Towers. I see you're way ahead of me. The official theory says that they collapsed because of the combined effect of the impact of the airplanes and the resulting fires. For example, the report put out by FEMA said, "The structural damage sustained by each tower from the impact, combined with the ensuing fires, resulted in the total collapse of each building." This theory clearly belongs to the category of outrageous theories, because it is contradicted by all the relevant facts. Now, that may seem like an extreme statement, but I'll try to show why it is not. The official theory is rendered implausible by two major problems. The first is the simple fact that fire has never caused steel-framed, high-rise buildings to collapse, whether before 9/11 or after 9/11. Defenders of the official theory do not like to remind you of this fact. Indeed, the supposedly definitive report put out by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, even implies that fire-induced total collapses of large steel-frame buildings are normal, regular occurring events. Far from being normal, such collapses had never occurred prior to 9/11. Defenders of the official theory, of course, say that the collapses were not caused simply by the fire, but by the fire combined with the damage caused by the airliners. The towers, however, were designed to withstand the impact of airliners about the same size as a Boeing 767. Hyman Brown, the construction manager of the Twin Towers, said they were over-designed to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, bombings, and an airplane hitting them. And even Thomas Eagar, an MIT professor of material science and engineering, who supports the official theory, says that the impact of the airplanes would have been insignificant because the number of columns lost on the initial impact was not large, and the loads were shifting to the remaining columns in this highly redundant structure. Likewise, the NIST report, in discussing how the impact of the planes contributed to the collapse, focuses primarily on the claim that the planes dislodged a lot of the fireproofing material from the steel. So the official theory is essentially a fire theory. So it cannot be overemphasized that fire has never caused large steel frame buildings to collapse. Not before 9/11, not after 9/11, not anywhere else in the world on 9/11 except allegedly New York City. Never. But of course people will say, well, there's a first time for everything. And they say that maybe a truly extraordinary fire might induce a total collapse. Let's look at this. What would count as a truly extraordinary fire? Given the properties of steel, a fire would need to be very hot, very big, and very long-lasting. But the fires in the towers did not have even one of these three characteristics, let alone all three. There have been claims, to be sure, that the fires were very hot. Some television specials early on claimed that the towers collapsed because the fire was hot enough to melt steel. This early BBC news special quoted a man who was presented as a structural engineer as saying, "It was the fire that killed the building. There's nothing on the earth that could survive those temperatures with that amount of fuel burning. The columns would have melted." But that claim is absurd. Steel does not even begin to melt until it reaches almost 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And an ordinary open-air hydrocarbon fire and kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, produces ordinary hydrocarbon fires. Such fires cannot get over 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're about 1,100 degrees short of the melting temperature of steel. So we can dismiss the claim that the buildings collapsed because the steel melted. And of course, most defenders of the official story don't make that absurd claim. Rather, they say merely that the fire heated the steel up to the point where it lost so much of its strength that it buckled or broke. For example, Thomas Eagar, saying that the steel loses 80% of its strength when it is heated to 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, argues that this is what happened. But even for this claim to be plausible, the fire would still have to be very hot. But it was not in any of the buildings. People have made claims about the thousands of gallons of jet fuel, but much of it burned up in the first few seconds in those tremendous fireballs outside the buildings, and the rest of it would have all been burned up in 10 minutes, and of course that's when the fires started to go down. Photographs of the towers 15 minutes after they were struck show very few flames and lots of black smoke, a sign that the fires were oxygen-starved. Thomas Eagar, recognizing this fact, says that the fires were probably only 1,200 to 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit. There are reasons to believe, moreover, that the fires were not even that hot. As photographs show, the fires did not break windows or even spread much beyond their points of origin on a given floor, suggesting they were not hot enough to burn plastic, paper, or wood. This photographic evidence, moreover, is supported by a scientific study by NIST itself, which indicated that they didn't find any steel that had been exposed to fires hotter than 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Moreover, even if the fires had reached 1,300 degrees, as Eagar supposes, that does not mean that any of the steel in the buildings would have heated up to that temperature, because steel is an excellent conductor of heat. If you've got a long bar of steel and you heat up one end of it, the heat will diffuse throughout the bar of steel and to any other bars of steel that it is connected to. For fires to have heated any of the steel columns to anywhere close to the temperature of the fires, they would have needed to be very big relative to the size of the building. And of course, the Twin Towers were enormous and they had an enormous amount of steel. A small localized fire of 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit would never have heated any of the steel columns even close to that temperature because the heat would have been quickly dispersed throughout the building. Defenders of the official theory have said that the fires were very big, turning the buildings into towering infernos. But all the evidence counts against this claim. especially with regard to the South Tower, which collapsed first. The South Tower was struck between floors 78 and 84. So that is where the fire would have been the greatest. And yet Brian Clark, a survivor, said that when he got down to the 80th floor, you could see through the wall and the cracks and see flames just licking up, not a roaring inferno, just quiet flames licking up and smoke sort of eking through the wall. Likewise, one of the fire chiefs who had reached the 78th floor found only two isolated pockets of fire. The North Tower, to be sure, did have fires that were big enough and hot enough to cause many people to jump to their deaths. But as anyone with a fireplace grate or a potbelly stove knows, fire that will not harm steel or even iron will burn human flesh. In any case, the fires, to weaken the steel columns, would have needed to be not only very hot and very big, but also very long-lasting. The public was told that this was true about the fires, with CNN saying that very intense fires burn for a long time. But they did not. The North Tower collapsed in an hour and 42 minutes after it was struck. The South Tower collapsed after only 56 minutes. For comparison, we can look at some other fires to see that it is ludicrous to claim that the fires in the towers could have induced structural collapse. In 1988, a fire in the First Interstate Bank building in Los Angeles raged for 3.5 hours and gutted 5 of this building's 62 floors. But there was no significant structural damage. In 1991, a huge fire in Philadelphia's One Meridian Plaza lasted for 18 hours and gutted 8 of the building's 38 floors. But, said the FEMA report about that fire, although beams and girders sagged and twisted under severe fire exposure, the columns continued to support their loads without obvious damage. In Caracas in 2004, a fire in a 50-story building raged for 17 hours, completely gutting the building's top 20 floors. Yet, it did not collapse. Unlike the fires in the towers, furthermore, all of those fires were hot enough to break the windows. Perhaps the most decisive comparison is provided by a series of experiments run in Great Britain in the mid-1990s to see what kind of damage could be caused by a really all-consuming, very hot, long-lasting fire. FEMA, having reviewed those experiments, said, despite the temperature of the steel beams reaching 1500 to 1700 degrees Fahrenheit in 3 of the tests, no collapse was observed in any of the experiments. These facts bring out the absurdity of NIST's claim that the towers collapsed because the planes knocked the fireproofing off the steel columns. Fireproofing provides protection for at most a few hours. So the steel in the buildings in Philadelphia and Caracas would have been directly exposed to raging fires for 14 or 15 hours. And yet this steel did not buckle. It is absurd to say that the steel in the South Tower buckled because it was directly exposed to flames for 56 minutes. There is a reverse truth to the fact that, aside from the alleged cases of 9/11, fire has never caused large steel frame buildings to collapse. This reverse truth is that every previous total collapse has been caused by the procedure known as controlled demolition, in which explosives capable of cutting steel have been placed in crucial places throughout the building and then set off in a particular order. So just from knowing that the towers came down, one would just naturally assume they were brought down by explosives, since that's the only way they've ever been brought down before. This a priori assumption, moreover, is supported by the particular nature of the collapses. Here we come to the second major problem with the official theory, namely that the collapses had at least 10 features that would be expected if, and only if, explosives were used. I will briefly indicate those 10 features. First, in controlled demolition, the onset of the collapse is sudden. One moment the building is perfectly still, the next moment it suddenly begins to collapse. But steel, when heated, does not suddenly buckle or break. So in fire-induced collapses, if we had ever had any examples of such, the onset would have been gradual. Horizontal beams and trusses would begin to sag. Vertical columns, if subjected to strong forces, would begin to bend. But as videos of the tower show, there were no signs of bending or sagging, even on the floors directly under the hole created by the impact of the airplane. Did I say below? I meant the floor just above the hole created by the impact. The buildings were perfectly motionless up to the moment that they began their collapse. Two, the most important thing in a controlled demolition of a tall building that is close to other buildings is that it comes straight down into its own footprint, or at least close to it, so that it does not destroy the other buildings. The whole art or science of controlled demolition is oriented primarily around this point. As Marc Loiseau, the president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated, has explained, to bring a building down as we want, so no other structure is harmed, the demolition must be completely planned, using the right explosive and the right pattern of laying the charge. If the 110-story Twin Towers had fallen over, they would have caused an enormous amount of damage in Lower Manhattan. But the towers came straight down. The official theory, therefore, requires a miracle, with fire-producing collapses that perfectly mimic the kind of collapses that have otherwise been produced only by very careful planning. Three, buildings brought down by controlled demolition collapse at almost free fall speed. This can occur because the supports for the lower floors are destroyed, so that when the upper floors come down, they encounter no resistance. The fact that the collapses of the towers mimic this feature of controlled demolition was indirectly mentioned by the 9/11 Commission, which said that the South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds. Now, that was actually an exaggeration. It's closer to 14 seconds, but it's still very close to free fall speed, particularly when you factor in the air. The authors of the report evidently thought that the rapidity of this collapse did not conflict with the official theory, which is a pancake theory, which says that above the hole created by the impact, the floors collapsed, bringing all those floors down on the floor below the level of impact, and then they pancaked all the way down. But if that is what happened, the lower floors, with all their steel and concrete, would have provided at least some resistance. The upper floors could not have fallen through them at the same speed as they would fall through the air. And yet the videos of the collapse show that the rubble falling inside the building's profile falls at the same speed as the rubble outside. Four, that theory, the official theory, is even more decisively ruled out by the fact that the collapses were total. These 110-story buildings collapsed into piles of rubble only a few stories high. This is problematic because the core of each tower contained 47 massive steel box columns. According to the pancake theory, the horizontal steel beams and trusses broke loose from these columns. But if that had been the case, then it would be like the old phonographs, the 78 phonographs, if you're old enough to know about those. The records would some kind pancake down, but you still have the spindle sticking up. We would have had 47 spindles still sticking up. The 9/11 Commission came up with a bold solution to this problem. It simply denied the existence of the 47 core columns. They said, the interior core of the building was a hollow steel shaft in which elevators and stairwells were grouped. Not making this stuff up. So, voila, with no core columns, the chief problem with total collapse is solved. The NIST report handled this most difficult problem by claiming that when the floors collapsed, they pulled on the columns, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached 1,832 degrees. And this combination of factors somehow produced what they call global collapse, which is their term for total collapse. Well, one problem with this is that, as I mentioned earlier, their own studies only showed fires of 500 degrees. So they added 1,300 degrees here out of the air in order to get the fire hot enough. And, of course, that's in the core of the building. The air would be coming from the windows, so the hottest fire would be around the periphery. There was a problem getting oxygen to the core. So the idea that the fires in the core were hotter is just contrary to any scientific understanding. Besides that problem, even if one could imagine that sequence of events occurred, there would have been no explanation. NIST gives no explanation of the total collapse. The NIST report simply asserts that column failure occurred and the core as well as the perimeter columns. In fact, it says it was inevitable, but it gives no explanation at all with no scientific rigor. It's just a bare assertion. Number five, in controlled demolitions of steel frame buildings, explosives are used to slice the steel columns and beams into pieces. A representative from Controlled Demolition, Inc. has said of RDX, one of the commonly used high explosives, that it slices steel like a razor blade through a tomato. The steel is, moreover, not merely sliced, it is sliced into manageable lengths. As Controlled Demolition, Inc. says in its publicity, our system segments steel components into pieces matching the lifting capacity of the available equipment. The collapses of the Twin Towers, it seems, somehow managed to mimic this feature of controlled demolitions as well. Jim Hoffman, after studying various photos of the collapses, of the collapse site, said that much of the steel seemed to be chopped up into sections that would be easily loaded onto the equipment that was cleaning up ground zero. Number six, another feature of controlled demolition is the production of a lot of dust, because explosives powerful enough to slice steel will pulverize concrete and any other non-metallic substances into very fine powder. And Hoffman reports, nearly all of the non-metallic constituents of the towers were pulverized into fine powder. That observation was made also by Colonel John O'Dowd of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. At the World Trade Center sites, he told the History Channel, it seemed like everything was pulverized. This fact creates a problem for the official theory, according to which the only energy available was gravitational energy, because that energy is completely unsuited to this kind of work, especially in the first few seconds. In Hoffman's words, you can see thick clouds of pulverized concrete being ejected within the first 2 seconds. That's when the relative motion of the top of the tower to the intact portion was only a few feet per second. So even if you had stood up on top of the Twin Towers and dropped concrete to the floor, 110 stories, you wouldn't get absolutely pulverized dust. So all the more can you not explain how in the first 2 seconds you got concrete pulverized into very fine powder when the gravitational pull was very small. The speed was very small. Number seven, another common feature of controlled demolitions are dust clouds, which result when explosions eject the dust from the building with great energy. And as one can see by comparing videos on the web, the collapses of the towers produced clouds that are very similar to those produced by controlled demolitions of other structures, such as Seattle's King Dome. The only difference is that the clouds produced during the collapses of the towers are much bigger, even relative to the size of the buildings, suggesting that much more energy was expended. The question of the source of this energy again arises. Hoffman, focusing on the expansion of the North Tower's dust cloud, calculates that the energy required simply for the expansion, looking aside from the energy required to slice the steel and pulverize the concrete, was at least 10 times greater than the available gravitational energy. The official account, therefore, involves a huge violation of the laws of physics, a violation that becomes even more enormous when we factor in the energy required to slice the steel and pulverize the concrete and virtually all the other materials. Number eight, another common feature of controlled demolition is the horizontal ejection of other materials besides dust from those areas of the building in which the explosives are set off. In the case of the Twin Towers, photos and videos reveal that heavy pieces of steel were injected in all directions for distances up to 500 feet, while aluminum cladding was blown up to 700 feet away from the towers. But gravitational energy is vertical. It cannot begin to explain these horizontal ejections. Number nine, still another common feature of collapses induced by explosives are demolition rings, in which series of small explosions run around a building very rapidly. This feature was also manifested. A tenth feature of collapses induced by explosives is, logically enough, sights and sounds suggestive of explosions. Some testimony suggestive of explosions in the towers provided by reporters, firefighters, medical workers, police officers, and people who worked in the towers has long been available. A few of these testimonies, such as those of janitor William Rodriguez, engineer Mike Pecoraro, firefighter Louis Caccioli, and employee Teresa Verlies, are very impressive. But until recently, we didn't have very many of these. But this situation has dramatically changed. Shortly after 9/11, the New York Fire Department recorded over 500 oral histories in which firefighters and emergency medical workers gave an account of their experiences of that day. Mayor Bloomberg's administration refused to release them to the public. But then the New York Times, joined by families of the victims, filed suit. They were rebuffed time and time again in the lower courts. But finally, the New York State Court of Appeals ordered the city to release them. And they did on August 12th. And the New York Times has now made these available on a website. So you can now read these oral testimonies for yourself. These testimonies contain many dozens of testimonies that speak of explosions and related phenomena characteristic of controlled demolition. So I will now give a few examples. Several individuals reported that they heard a single explosion followed by the collapse of one of the towers. But several people reported multiple explosions. Paramedic Kevin Darnowski said, "I heard three explosions, and then Tower 2 started to come down." Firefighter Thomas Turilli said, "It almost sounded like bombs going off, like boom, 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 like seven or eight." Craig Carlson said that he and other firefighters heard explosions coming from the South Tower. There were about 10 explosions. We then realized the building started to come down. Firefighter Joseph Mayola said, "It looked like the building was blowing out on all four sides. We actually heard the pops." Paramedic Daniel Rivera also mentioned pops. Asked how he knew that the South Tower was coming down, he said, "It was a frigging noise. I thought it was, do you ever see professional demolition where they set the charges on certain floors and then you hear pop, 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 pop? I thought it was that." According to the official account, the pancaking began when the floors above the hole caused by the airplane fell on the floors below. But some witnesses reported that the collapse began lower down. Timothy Burke, speaking of the South Tower, said that the building popped lower than the fire. Firefighter Edward Kachia, also speaking of the South Tower, said it actually gave at a lower floor, not the floor where the plane was hit. "We originally had thought that there was like an internal detonation, explosive, because it went in succession, boom, 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 and then the tower came down." Some of the witnesses spoke of flashes and a phenomena suggestive of demolition rings. Assistant Commissioner Stephen Gregory said, "I thought before number two came down, I saw low-level flashes. I saw flash, flash, flash at the lower level of the building. You know, like when they demolish a building?" Captain Karen DeShore said, "Somewhere around the middle, there was this orange and red flash coming out. Initially, it was just one flash. Then this flash just kept popping all the way around the building, and that building started to explode. Firefighter Richard Benesiski, speaking of the South Tower, said, "There was just an explosion. It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions." Deputy Commissioner Thomas Fitzpatrick said, "It looked like sparkling around one specific layer of the building. My initial reaction was that this was exactly the way it looks when they show you those implosions on TV." A few witnesses spoke of horizontal ejections. Chief Frank Crothers said, "There was what appeared to be an explosion. It appeared at the very top, simultaneously from all four sides. Material shot out horizontally. And then there seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse." Now, that's very important because defenders of the official theory say that these horizontal ejections were caused when the floors collapsed and pushed the material out. So listen to firefighter James Curran, who said, "I looked back and I heard like every floor went choo-choo-choo. I looked back and from the pressure, everything was getting blown out of the floors before it actually collapsed." If all these firefighters and medical workers witnessed all these phenomena suggestive of controlled demolition, it might be wondered why you have not heard much about this. Part of the answer is probably provided by Auxiliary Lieutenant Fireman Paul Isaac. Having said that there were definitely bombs in those buildings, Isaac added that many other firemen know there were bombs in the buildings, but they're afraid for their jobs to admit it because higher-ups forbid discussion of this fact. So we have not heard about this because although Isaac said that sometime back, it has not been on the evening news or in the 9/11 Commission report. These facts taken together render the likelihood of the official theory essentially zero. In fact, each of the 10 phenomena, the likelihood of it occurring without explosives being used is by itself essentially zero. But let's be generous and suggest maybe there's a 1% chance that these things could occur. Virtual free fall speed, straight down, enormous amount of dust. 1% chance. But when you figure up the probabilities then, when you say how many, that two of them would occur, three of them would occur, by the time you get up to 10 of them occurring without explosive, you're talking about the likelihood of one in a trillion. So we can say that the official theory about the towers is disproved as thoroughly as any such theory could possibly be, whereas all the evidence can be explained by the alternative theory according to which the towers were brought down by explosives. The official theory is therefore an outrageous theory, whereas the alternative theory is, from a scientific point of view, the only possible theory. Moreover, even though I've already given enough evidence for the alternative theory, there is still more. For one thing, the steel from the buildings was quickly removed before it could be properly examined, with virtually all of it being sold to scrap dealers and most of it being put on ships to Asia where it would be melted down. Generally, removing any evidence from a fire scene is a federal crime. You cannot pick up a matchbook. And yet in this case, enormous pieces of steel were picked up with the assistance of the federal officials. This removal evoked protest. On Christmas Day 2001, the New York Times said, "The decision to rapidly recycle the steel columns, beams, and trusses from the World Trade Center in the days immediately after 9/11 means definitive answers may never be known." The next week, Fire Engineering Magazine said, "We are literally treating the steel removed from the site like garbage, not like crucial fire scene evidence. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately." But it did not. It went on, and Mayor Bloomberg defended the decision to dispose of the steel, saying, "If you want to look at the construction methods and the design, that's in this day and age what computers do. Just looking at a piece of metal generally doesn't tell you anything. But of course, it might tell you something. It would tell you whether the steel was broken by the use of explosives. The suggestion that explosives might have been placed in the towers raises the question of how anyone could have gotten access to the towers in order to plant the explosives. This question brings us to a possibly relevant fact about a company then called Securicom that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. From 1993 to 2000, during which Securicom installed a new security system, Marvin Bush, the president's brother, was one of the directors of the company. And from 1999 until January of 2002, their cousin, Wirt Walker III, was the CEO. One would think these facts might have made the evening news, or at least the 9/11 Commission report, but they did not. These facts, in any case, may be relevant to some reports given by people who had worked in the World Trade Center. Some of them reportedly said that although in the weeks before 9/11, there had been a security alert that mandated the use of bomb-sniffing dogs, that alert was lifted 5 days before 9/11. Also, a man named Scott Forbes, who worked for Fiduciary Trust, the company for which Kristen Breitweiser's husband worked, has written, "On the weekend of September 8, 2001, there was a power-down condition in the South Tower. This power-down condition meant that there was no electrical supply for approximately 36 hours from floor 50 up. The reason given by the World Trade Center for the power-down was that cabling in the tower was being upgraded. Of course, without power, there were no security cameras, no security locks on doors, while many engineers were coming in and out of the towers, out of the tower. Also, a man named Ben Fountain, who was a financial analyst with Fireman's Fund in the South Tower, was quoted in People's Magazine as saying that during the weeks before 9/11, the towers were evacuated a number of times and that this was highly unusual. One more possibly relevant fact is that then Mayor Rudy Giuliani, talking on ABC News about his temporary emergency command center at 75 Barclay Street, said, "We were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could get out of the building." Well, this is an amazing statement. Prior to that time, fire had never brought down a steel-framed high-rise building. The fireman who reached the 78th floor of the South Tower certainly did not believe that the building was about to collapse. Even the 9/11 Commission said that, to its knowledge, none of the fire chiefs present believed that a total collapse of either tower was possible. So why in the world would have anyone told Giuliani that at least one of the towers was going to collapse? The most reasonable answer, especially in light of the evidence we have now looked at, is that someone knew that explosives had been placed in the towers and were about to be discharged. It is even possible that the explosives in the South Tower were going to be discharged earlier than originally planned because the fires in the South Tower were burning down, dying out more quickly than perhaps expected because the plane that hit the South Tower hit it at a corner and so much of the jet fuel went outside, which is why the fireball in the South Tower was so much bigger. But that does not mean it was a bigger tower inferno. It means less because there was less fuel inside to get the fire going. This could explain why the South Tower, which was struck second, suffered less structural damage and had smaller fires, collapsed first after only 56 minutes. That is, if the official story is going to be the fires brought the tower down, the fires had better still be burning when the tower comes down. We now learn from the oral histories, moreover, that Giuliani is not the only one who was told that a collapse was coming. At least four of the recently released oral histories indicate that shortly before the collapse of the South Tower, the Office of Emergency Management had predicted the collapse of at least one tower. The director of this office reported directly to Giuliani. So although Giuliani said that he and others were told that the towers were going to collapse. It was his own people who were doing the telling. As New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer has pointed out, the 9/11 Commission had access to these 9/11 oral histories. They should have discussed these facts, but of course they did not. Another matter not discussed by the Commission was the collapse of Building 7. And yet the official story about it is, if anything, even more problematic than the official story about the towers. But before I go on to that discussion, we are going to see the videos.
You're listening to Professor David Ray Griffin discussing evidence of the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center towers on 9/11/2001. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, RadioVeronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Back to David Ray Griffin.
Okay, let me reread my final sentence to move into this last part. Another matter not discussed by the commission was the collapse of Building 7, and yet the official story about it is, if anything, even far more problematic than the official story about the collapse of the towers, because it was even more difficult to explain. Because Building 7, of course, was not struck by an airplane. So all of the theories we've had about how the airplanes somehow contributed to the collapse of the towers cannot be used with regard to Building Number 7. And that is a huge problem. Also, all the photographic evidence suggests that the fires in this building were very small, not very hot, and limited to a few floors. Photographs of the north side of Building 7 show fires only on the 7th and 12th floors of that 47-story building. So if the south side, which faced the towers, had fires on many other floors, as defenders of the official theory say, the fires were not big enough to be seen from the back of the building. Of course, it would not be surprising if the fires in the South Tower were much smaller, because there was no explosion and no jet fuel to get them going. Defenders of the official theory, of course, claim that the diesel fuel that was in the building somehow got set on fire and turned Building 7 into a towering inferno. But if that's the case, why, of all the photographers and videographers who were around that area that afternoon, why did not a single one of them capture this towering inferno on film? The extreme difficulty of explaining the collapse of Building 7, assuming, of course, that we cannot mention explosives, has been recognized by the official bodies. The report prepared under FEMA's supervision came up with a scenario, rather fantastic scenario, by which Building 7 might have collapsed. This was a scenario using the diesel fuel. And yet at the end of this account, FEMA says, this scenario has only a low probability of occurrence. But even that statement is generous, because the possibility that some version of the official story about Building 7 is true is the same as it is for the towers, essentially zero, because it would violate several laws of physics. In any case, the 9/11 Commission, perhaps because of this admission by FEMA, handled the problem by simply not mentioning that Building 7 collapsed.